from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, in the 1970s, UCSF's medical school made a series of notable advances in biological research, including the discovery of DNA cloning and the identification of the first cancer genes. Dr. Henry Bourne chronicles what he calls this burst of discovery in his new book, Paths to Innovation. He'll join us in studio for the hour. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. UCSF Medical Professor Emeritus and Biological Researcher Henry Bourne joins us in studio this Forum Hour, a member of the National Academy of Sciences and a widely published researcher. He was a newspaper reporter before he became a physician and cell biologist and authored the memoir Ambition and Delight. More recently, the University of California Medical Humanities Consortium published his book Paths to Innovation, Discovering Recombinant DNA, Oncogenes and Prions in One Medical School Over One Decade. Dr. Henry Bourne joins us in studio for this Forum Hour. Good to have you here. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Michael.
Well, I think you began with a question here. And the question I'll frame for our listeners was, how could a bunch of provincial pygmies, as they were called by someone over at UC, on Parnassus have established this extraordinary institution and have so much thriving, three Nobel recipients and so forth within a decade? That's really the question you set out to answer in some ways, isn't it?
Yes. And the striking thing about it, I set out to answer that question and immediately, of course, realized that I was dealing, that I actually believed what turned out to be a myth about how that happened. All great institutions have myths about their birth and their development, and they all have an element of truth, but in fact, they make up things. And that's what UCSF had done. And I discovered that to my great surprise. And I have to say I was delighted to be surprised because it actually gave me something to talk about. The myth is interesting.
It's kind of a great man of history myth, isn't it? There's something along those lines?
That it was essentially that there were heroes who came in. They vanquished evil forces and pushed and brought in great people along behind them, and everything was wonderful. That's really not quite what happened. It's much more interesting and complicated than that. And what it is in part chance and in part perfectly fertile ground that nobody really knew was fertile until there was growth in it. What happened, I think, is that UCSF was a provincial medical school. It was a very good provincial medical school. It did wonderful patient care, and it didn't do much in the way of science. This is now back in the 1950s. And there was a series of things that were happening in the 50s and 60s in California that were enormously important. One was that education was running wild with students who came back from the war, who migrated to California. The economy was going very well in the 50s, and politicians wanted to build increase the size of the University of California. So there were resources. Nobody much paid attention to the resources except people like Clark Kerr and the people who were making these things to be built. And Kerr wanted UCSF to be the medical school of the University of California, the premier medical school. It wasn't. What happened was a series of appearances of people on the scene, plus a few prescient hires, made all the difference. And the real difference essentially was that California in those days felt to people on the East Coast like a kind of a promised land. It was a place where almost anything could happen. We had Carol Doda. We had the City Lights.
Was that what made us a promised land?
Well, the Carol Doda was enormously attractive to one of the Nobel Prize winners who I interviewed. In his first interview here, he was taken to see Carol Doda down on Broadway, and that plus the City Lights bookstore sold him on coming to San Francisco. That was Michael Bishop, who was our chancellor,
and who is a Nobel laureate.
Yes.
There's a sense, though, that you're grappling with this whole question of I mean, you talk about really a meteoric rise of this institution and what makes for – what really is the environment that makes for a great and sterling institution? And it has to do a lot with personality, certainly. I mean, you can't discount that. You had some very charismatic and extraordinary people right from the beginning of this movement upward, this trajectory upward. But you also have people who are unusual, who are adventurers, who are independent spirits that come together and they sort of cross-fertilize each other.
And it's the adventure that was the most important part of it. They saw UCSF and San Francisco and all of California as a place to do what they wanted to do without bosses, without people telling him what to do, without hierarchies, or, as Mike Bishop said, without somebody keeping score all the time. And so, in a sense, UCSF had resources, but what it also had was the huge advantage of not having been a famous place that attracted a lot of people who would sit around and tell everybody what to do. There weren't a lot of bosses. And everybody who came here, both the what I call the face cards in the deck, the people who were organizers and made UCSF administratively a wonderful place to be, and the wild cards, the scientists, in both cases, they were escaping from a hierarchical world back in the East where there was somebody famous in just about every big medical school and institution who knew how to do it and wanted you to make sure that you knew that he knew.
Yeah, the pecking order was much more rigid.
It was very
and hierarchical.
Clear.
I'm often struck in your work by this poker metaphor, though, of the face cards and the wild cards.
Right.
Talk a little bit about how you see that operating at UC specifically.
Well, the face cards, every institution has face cards. These are the people that everyone knows are in charge. There was a huge change in the face cards that occurred in the mid-60s to the early 70s that ultimately changed the whole direction of the medical school from an administrative point of view. These were people brought in mostly from the East Coast and mostly escaping hierarchies there where they wanted to do something new and different.
Excuse me, like Izzy Edelman escaping anti-Semitism. In fact.
Right, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Anti-Semitism and being accused of being a communist because he took the Daily Worker on Sundays for 1 year, and that had him being interviewed before the Congress all the time. It was difficult to get grants because he might be traducing the state in some way. So they were getting away from that, and UCSF was open to them. But the wild cards are people who came in essentially all four of the people that I focused on as scientists, Herb Boyer, Mike Bishop, Harold Varmus, and Stan Prusiner, they all arrived here essentially under the radar of the big folks at UCSF. Nobody was very impressed with them when they appeared. It wasn't that they weren't good. They had good credentials. But what they did was not important to people. And so nobody particularly wanted to tell them what to do.
We should tell for our listeners, because you named the four Nobel Prize winners out of UC, and Varmus and Harold Varmus, Mike Bishop were co recipients of the Nobel Prize, Stanley Prusiner for prions, and Herbert Boyer. Let's talk
about.
He
didn't get the Nobel, but he.
Oh, I thought he got a Nobel too. I'm sorry. So I just named the three Nobel recipients
right,
then.
Right.
Talk a little bit about their work. I mean, particularly Stan Prusiner's as well as Varmus and Bishop's. I mean, what they got the Nobel Prize for example.
Okay. They were both very important medical discoveries. And all three of those people were MDs. Mike Bishop and Harold Varmus discovered the first cancer genes. Everyone by that time suspected that there were cancer genes, but nobody had actually found one. And they did was to show that a cancer gene transmitted by a virus, Ross sarcoma virus, was actually a gene that was stolen and slightly mutated, changed in the virus, but stolen from a chicken then propagated to other chickens in a very powerfully activated form that caused cancer in chickens.
And this is a major breakthrough.
It was a major breakthrough because it showed what people suspected, that cancer was a genetic disease, but it also opened the way to understanding the pathways that actually cause different kinds of cancers. They're not all caused by any means by the cancer, by the gene that they found, but other oncogenes, cancer genes, do that. So now that we know that, there are therapies targeted directly against cancer genes that actually can cure certain kinds of leukemia, for example. So it was a huge, huge conceptual step, and it opened a world of a scientific exploration that's going on today.
And let's talk about Stan Prusiner's breakthrough. Stan Prusiner, who continues to tell me that prions are the answer to perhaps the problems that we're looking for with stem cell research. If we go in that way, I think, you know, he's a true believer, and he's discovered again something that really was an extraordinary breakthrough.
Well, Stan is kind of the wildest of the wild cards that I described. He came here as an intern in medicine, and distinguished himself essentially by asking everybody lots of questions and disagreeing with people regardless of their stature and fame in the little hierarchy at UCSF. Then he went off to the NIH and learned some biochemistry and came back here in neurology. And in his first year as a neurology resident, he had a patient from Marin County, a woman who had a strange and unusual dementia that was quite rare. It's called Jakob Creutzfeldt disease. He got very interested in that disease, essentially reading that nobody knew what it was.
It's what we call mad cow, isn't it, pretty much?
It's now mad cow.
Yeah.
It was thought to be a slow virus. Nobody really knew what it was, and it was extremely rare. But there was a tribe in New Guinea that got it by cannibalism, transmitted from people. So that was the first mad cow. It was actually human beings. And what Stan did was to make it his business. He decided that when he became a faculty member, he would focus on this disease. He was told by many people that it was a fool's errand, that there were already very brilliant people trying to work on it. They weren't getting anywhere. And furthermore, he was told by authorities at UCSF that it was not a dignified thing for a neurologist who ought to be treating disease and teaching patients to be working on a disease that was actually transmitted in animals mostly when you studied it. Sheep get it. It's called scrapie. And it wasn't a dignified thing for him to be working on that. He worked on it very, very hard and made very little progress, not because he wasn't doing the right experiments, but because it turned out to be immensely mysterious in the way it actually worked. It didn't fit with any previous way of understanding transmission of disease or causation of any disease. And he essentially ruled out or did experiments that said it was not a DNA RNA disease. It was not nucleic acids, which were the rage at that time. And finally discovered that it was transmission of a protein, which is a product encoded by DNA and RNA, but the protein itself does the transmission. It's not a virus. It's just a little protein. And that was an extraordinary step because it opened a new way of causing disease that we have to really reckon with in the modern day. It looks as if there are many, many dimensions and neurological diseases that are not transmitted from patient to patient in that way, but are propagated within the brain in a way that Stan ultimately worked out. So it's an immensely exciting thing that happened. All of these things happened in a place that was not prepared for them. Nobody knew these guys were going to do anything extraordinary. Nobody cared about what they were doing. And in fact,
but there may be a lesson there, isn't there?
I mean,
that they had the independence and autonomy to do what they wanted to do.
That's exactly right. What happened was that except for Stan, who got some opposition to what he was doing, in part because of his personality and his acerbic comments to other people, but in part because he wasn't doing what everybody wanted neurologists to do.
What was considered dignified research.
That's right. Yeah. But the rest of them were sort of ignored until they made their discoveries. Once they made their discoveries, Stan and all the rest of them were enormously rewarded. But along the way, they were kind of ignored. And that turned out to be a superb way to make things happen, but only in the 60s and 70s. Now it would not be. And the reason is that there was money from the NIH that could support their work.
And now the money comes in with fast results for the most part, and now there's a lot of aversion to these kind of risks and this kind of independence that we're talking about. I mean, I don't want to frame this as being something we should be disconsolate about, but the fact of the matter is that we've taken a pretty quantum leap in the other direction, haven't we?
Well, the UCSF is trying to take that leap. And there's
a leap back to the kind of which leap are you talking about?
Well, what they're trying to do is to what they do they call translational medicine. And translational medicine, by its the very ethos, is not this individualistic, pioneering people going out in the wilderness discovering new continents kind of thing. It is taking knowledge that we already have and trying to apply it in ways that really will make a difference. It's enormously important to do that. It's also very, very difficult to do it. But it's not something that any one person can do. It's not amenable to the kind of approach that Boyer and Mike and Harold and Stan took back in the 60s and 70s. It's much more collaborative. It requires some hierarchy. And the trick they have to accomplish is to have hierarchy, to have control in a way, but also to allow innovation to occur and to foster it. And they're doing that by trying to get people to collaborate with one another.
Well, also collaborate with a lot of – in fact, when the chancellor was on, we had Susan Desmond-Hellman on, and there was a good deal of criticism, which I thought she fielded quite well, about too much collaboration with private industry because she comes from Genentech, concern about movement toward privatization, concern about maybe moving away from the UC system and becoming more autonomous, which wouldn't necessarily, in your paradigm, be a bad thing because it would break down at least one kind of hierarchical structure. But I think what you're saying here is that when you break down these hierarchical structures, they usually redound to the advantage of the institution.
Well, they do sometimes and not other times. It depends on what you want to do. And what you need is a hierarchical structure that is really flexible, that can change. Well, that's almost a contradiction in terms. Forget politics. It is human beings who make a bureaucratic structure want to keep that going. The people who are running it want to stay there and do what they're doing. And that's what we've got to work out ways of getting around, to have the thing renew itself. And that, I think, is the big problem that all science and all biomedical science especially is facing right now, is that essentially discovery makes new knowledge over and over and over, and we have to somehow change our ways to catch up with that and allow more new knowledge to occur. And what the tendency of all human beings is to do what they did last week rather than what they could do next year.
I think it's called complacency, Henry. We're talking, by the way, if you just joined us, with Dr. Henry Bourne, who is professor emeritus from UCSF and who has written a book all about the rather extraordinary changes that went on at UC San Francisco. Many continue to go on. There's still a lot of National Institute of Health money and some great research going on there. But what made it a world leader? And what made it a world leader has a lot to do with innovations in recombinant DNA and biotech industry, or what led to the biotech industry, discovery of prions, mutant genes that really were identified with triggering cancer. His book is called Paths to Innovation, and I'm going to open the phone lines and invite those of you who are listening to join us. In fact, we welcome your phone calls and your involvement in the program, and you are free to join this conversation. So the way to do that is either by phone. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786, and we do welcome your calls. 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you have on our website, which is kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment or go to our Facebook page. And talking about large questions like what makes for a thriving environment of, a first-rate institution and an institution that can create innovative and, in many ways, Nobel Prize-winning science or Nobel Prize-winning whatever. It's not only, of course, scientific research when we're talking about institutions like UCSF and the glory days that it had. I would, I knew quite a number of the characters that you write about in your book, and I want to sort of give my props here, whatever it is, to Gordon Tompkins and Bill Rutter, who were both kind of on the ground floor of all this. I mean, Gordy Tompkins was just an amazing, he was one of the most consummate Renaissance men I've ever met. A musician, a gifted musician and scientist, and a man with a great deal of charisma. And getting this history down was, I think, clearly something, and profiling these people, all of whom you knew or you had access to and so forth, was something that you were driven to do.
Well, it's Gordon Tompkins was my guru when I first came to UCSF, as he was for dozens and dozens of young scientists here. He was immensely charismatic, and intelligent and imaginative, but he was also immensely generous. He really liked to see other people succeed. Herb Boyer talked about that. Championed Boyer when everybody else thought he was barking up a tree that didn't need barking. He did that with lots and lots of people. You always felt when you came away from a conversation with him that he was immensely smart, but that you were smarter than you had thought you were, which is an astonishing thing for a smart person to do. It's, in fact, almost unheard of.
Well, there's some of the great men theory again, and the generosity that Gordon Tompkins was able to pass around. Again, the book is Paths to Innovation. It's written by Dr. Henry Bourne. It's part of the Perspectives of Medical Humanities, new consortium publishing a number of books, and maybe we'll find out more about that. But in the meantime, find out what's on your mind. Some of you may have something to offer or contribute to this conversation, so we welcome your calls. Again, it's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post questions or comments on our website at kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment or go to our Facebook page. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is UCSF Medical Professor Emeritus and Biological Researcher Henry Bourne, who is a member of the National Academy of Sciences and the author of Paths to Innovation, Discovering Recombinant DNA, Oncogenes, Prions in One Medical School Over One Decade. Extraordinary story about UC San Francisco and about those who made that institution really world famous and world class. Here's a listener, Alana, who says, I'm enjoying the show. Thank you. There have been several references to Prusner, Bishop, and Varmus as UCSF's Nobel laureates, as if they are the only laureates at UCSF. Elizabeth Blackburn won the Nobel Prize for Medicine in 2009. Thank you. In fact, we featured her on this program. And goes on this listener to say, if memory serves, there are other laureates as well, but I'm sure Dr. Bourne can speak to that better than I. But we're talking about a particular period here.
Yes. Yeah.
And in fact, there are many distinguished scientists at UCSF. Let's go to our callers, and we begin, Margaret, with you. Good morning.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My father graduated from medical school at UC in 46, and he returned after a stint in the Navy in 50 and was there till 53 during his residency, and then was on the faculty from 53 to 74. So this period that your speaker is talking about is certainly something that was part of my life growing up. I'm really fascinated to hear him invoke the name of Carol Doda, and also to suggest that there wasn't a very established old boys situation at Cal. I would suggest you look at Dr. Hinman in urology, Dr. Stone in radiology, J.B. to C.M. Saunders. These were men who were definitely cut out of the old cloth of a hierarchical educational institution. It's nonsense to suggest that wasn't the case. I would also suggest that the idea that left-leaning peoples were welcome at Cal, the loyalty oath you had to sign to be an employee of the UC system was in existence well into the 70s. So I'll take my response on the air, but I'm fascinated by what I would consider to be a mistelling of this story. So thank you.
All right, thank you. Well, are we hearing a mistelling or are we hearing some spin from you on this, Henry Bourne?
Well, I'm not certain what you mean by the mistelling, but I
think you're saying it was a lot more hierarchical,
yeah.
And then perhaps you've been framing it.
Let me try to say what I think you're saying, and then answer it. That, as you know, that's what people usually do when they want to give a good answer. They reframe the question. But I'm going to try to do it honestly. What it sounds like to me you're saying is that UCSF really did have people who were extraordinarily good at medical care and at education and were thoughtful folks long before these people came on the scene and that it was not a sort of a nothing institution. And I agree with that. It was an excellent institution in its education and service to patients before these people came on the scene. What it didn't have was scientists who were doing really new things. And that happened essentially in a process that was under the radar of the kinds of people you described, was not especially helped by them, nor was it hindered by them because these people were simply the new people who were coming in their view, the new scientists, weren't visible to them. And what they did was because science was changing and because the National Institutes of Health was beginning to give out lots of money for research, its budget was increasing rapidly in the 60s, they made extraordinary discoveries. I think what really the point I wanted to make is that these discoveries were made because UCSF was here, but not because UCSF consciously or purposely tried to help make them happen. Now we do a lot to try to make discoveries happen. Then they just sort of happened in part because they were not supervised by people whose views about what was important were wonderful and strong, but not scientific.
I think you're suggesting there was just more of a kind of, I'll use a medical word, or idiopathic freedom that was allowed,
yes,
or permitted, or that it had that kind of built into the environment. But she also mentioned the loyalty oath, and certainly that was true out here as well. When you think about people migrating out here because they, well, whether it was Carol Doda or communism or being labeled communist, there was a sense of that McCarthyism that certainly infested California's institutions too.
Well, and it was a big deal for Clark Kerr, as you know. He took the loyalty oath but defended the right of faculty members not to sign it. And that was a thorn in his side when he was being considered for the presidency for the leadership of the University of California. But he did that, and then ultimately Ronald Reagan got rid of him, accusing him essentially of being a sort of a pink or closet communist who was allowing
a crypto-Bolshevik, I think.
Yes, and allowing the free speech movement to take place. So there were lots of things going on in the background in California that fortunately the scientists were able to kind of evade or not pay much attention to and go ahead and do their own rebellions in the lab.
Well, let's go ahead and bring in more of our callers. And Pat, you're on with us. Good morning.
Good morning. I wonder if our guest might comment on the rather parallel change that went on the peninsula when Stanford purposely moved onto campus to, in fact, in a very purposeful way, change it from a fine clinical medical school to, in fact, a first-class research institute. And this sort of parallel cross-fertilization that went on between UCSF and Stanford Medical School.
The best part of the fertilization, in a way, was that when they each changed in the late 1950s, with Stanford bringing its clinicians and clinical presence down to Palo Alto and UCSF bringing its basic sciences over from Berkeley to San Francisco, what that did was to give each of them a different place to work, so they didn't have to compete. They had previously been occupying the San Francisco General Hospital in different wards, but taking care of patients there. Both were good medical schools. Doctors occasionally worked for both, but mostly worked for one or the other. And many of their clinicians stayed here in San Francisco because their patients were here.
But the merger was really a disaster. I mean,
you could have anticipated it as a disaster. Yeah.
No, I know it was much later, but I think everything kind of moved on a trajectory toward that merger because things were working, as you're suggesting, pretty well for a while.
Right. And they worked extremely well. And they worked well for both places. It was a wonderful time for medical care. There was a time when Medicare, which is now felt to be something that doesn't pay the bills as it should, was the only game in town. It was at the time Medicare was started, all of the indigent patients or people without insurance were paid for by the medical school if they were hospitalized at all. Suddenly there was this huge influx. That happened in 1965, and Stanford and UCSF profited immensely from suddenly having a new source of clinical income that allowed them to expand clinical care and to hire lots of new docs and do wonderfully innovative things in the clinic as well as in the laboratory.
What brought you out here? You were a Virginia boy, as I recall, and actually a newspaper guy, an aspiring novelist, then wound up in medicine and doing biomedical research. But why UCSF?
Well, I had my medical career was I went to Hopkins to medical school, and then I went to Columbia and the NIH after that. I was at Columbia as a house officer and the NIH as a Yellow Beret. A Yellow Beret was a person who got out of going into the Vietnam War by doing research or working on an Indian reservation.
Yellow as in cowardly?
Yes. That was the joke. I think there were some cowards among us. And I was not, I confess, very interested in going to Vietnam and was able to do that.
We shared that lack of interest, you and I. We're talking, by the way, if you just joined us, with Dr. Henry Bourne, and his book is Paths to Innovation. What kind of advice would you give now that you're a sage and an elder to, say, young scientists aspiring to do research, and particularly that would lead them toward the kind of path you're talking about here?
Well, I think the real key to success is to realize that for, on their parts, is to realize two things. One is that the opportunities are absolutely magnificent in the sense that discovery has gotten to the point now where we know a vast amount, and we really do need to begin to put that together in new ways. There are lots of new discoveries to be made, and there are lots of applications that need to be made. The second thing is that it is said to be extremely difficult to get a grant, to keep a research career going, and live a life. That is, back in my day, nobody wanted to live a life because we thought that working was what you did. And that was a wonderful world where women stayed home and took care of the kids and did all the real work, and we just went to work. That's no longer possible. So things have really changed.
You're going to get the ire up calling that a wonderful world, just describing characterizing
it. Well, it was a wonderful world for a selfish scientist.
Yeah.
It was not a wonderful world in many other ways. Now,
not for the
we
women.
Fixed that.
Yeah.
But what we have is a situation where it's really hard to learn how to be a doctor and a scientist. It's impossible for some people because of finances and many other things. So it is tough. On the other hand, the rewards are immense. And what I think people have to do is to take risks. And nobody wants to take risks anymore, but it's actually the way to get somewhere. So I think what you have to do is to say, yes, this is a risk. I'm going to take it and do the best I can. And the goals are very much worth that risk.
And we'll go to more calls here. We're talking again with Dr. Henry Bourne, his book, Paths to Innovation. And Lee, join us. You're on.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for the program, Michael. My question just was sort of dovetails into the issue of risk and also blue sky research, because you were talking about how there's less money and there's less focus and also sort of less patience in terms if I'm incorrectly, you know, sort of rephrasing that, and I'm just wondering what are the various sources of funding that could replace some of those higher risk sources of discovery funds that in the past were coming from the NIH, and what do you see downstream? How does that adversely affect us in our discovery of new ideas that are sort of outside of what everybody else is sort of focused on in these translational efforts?
Well, several things here. First of all, just before we get back to the money thing, the translational effort is not stealing money from other kinds of discovery. It is an important area of discovery itself. That is to say, there are many, many problems in medical care that are enormously difficult intellectually and practically that require innovative interventions. And those will use knowledge that is already there from a biological perspective, but it's a very creative and important thing to do. But the other side of that is, now back to the money. It's not that we don't have money. The U.S. spends more money on medical care biomedical research, rather, than probably the top six or seven countries
all those combined.
Combined. Yeah. So we're spending lots of money. The problem is essentially how to distribute it, and it's also compounded by the fact that we have built a research system that is absolutely requires growth, a constant growth, in order to survive. And the reason it does that is that the people who actually do the work are the people who are in training. And those people who are in training go out and want jobs, and so they apply for grants. So it appears that there isn't any money left. when in fact what we really have is a surplus of people applying. Now, that actually, I think, does have a constricting effect on innovation because it prevents people from doing things that might be more creative because they, by God, they have to put food on the table and get their grants funded. And so they say they're going to do something that maybe they've already done or that they know exactly how to do, and they can get that approved. So these are big problems, but we have to deal with them. And I think there are lots of moves afoot, which I could spend hours discussing with you.
Well, let's just talk, though, about how you maybe encourage in this kind of climate now, and resources dwindling, admittedly, particularly in the institutions, how you encourage these kind of outliers, because that's really what they are.
Yeah. So the outlier, I think we do absolutely need the outliers. We need to attract them. One of the, and we need then to foster them. And that's true actually in the translational world as well. But it's also true in the basic science world. What I have hoped for is that we could create little enclaves where there would be a small group of scientists who would not have huge labs, but relatively small labs, and would be encouraged to do exactly what they want to do, and given a number of years to fail, like 7 years to fail, with careful observation and help from everybody, but
that's not where science goes. It goes toward bigger and bigger labs.
I mean, bigger and bigger labs. But I think a lot of the innovations can occur in the basic science side of it in very small labs.
Yeah, I like that idea. Here's, in fact, a listener named Chris. And by the way, you can join us by email, forum@kqed.org, or you can call in your thoughts or questions and comments to 866-733-6786. And Chris writes, I would like to see more bursts like this, but in today's political climate, it seems less likely. Any ideas on how to make science the ivory tower it once was in a world of skeptics and Santorum?
Well, it will never be an ivory tower, and it wasn't an ivory tower back in the day either. In fact, I quote in the book a scientist who went off to the Rockefeller who said that he left UC Berkeley because it was not possible to do what he called pure research, he could only do it at the Rockefeller. Well, you know, research is never pure because it's a human activity. Human beings don't engage in pure activities.
There may not be pure research, but what there isn't enough of, and we keep hearing a lament about this, is just R&D, particularly, you know, funding for R&D.
Yeah, and that's got – there's several places it can come from. One is that industry needs to, I think, recognize that they're not doing as good a job of it as they should be. The pharmaceutical industry is backing off from doing research now.
Well, particularly things that don't bring big profits. Windfall profits is what they've been after all along.
Right. And they want a big drug that will be given to zillions of people, when in fact many of the important drugs that are now being developed work only on a small subset of patients but do wonderful things for them. And cancer is now no longer a disease that you just blast with a few toxins. What you can do sometimes is to treat a specific molecular disease. That is going to be, I think, the wave of the future, and we have to do more basic research to make that happen.
That and, I would submit, nanotechnology. I mean, we're moving in so many different directions on that front as well. I just happen to be doing some reading about this recently, and I'm impressed with at least the possibilities there. And they're exciting.
And synthetic biology.
And synthetic biology, right. I mean, in fact, I've been involved with the Siebel Scholars. They did synthetic biology last year. This year they're doing nanotechnology, and it's just fascinating, the new vistas and new frontiers, really. And we'll go to more of your calls. Ryan, join us. Hi.
Hi there. I was interested in a particular part of a comment he made about the marriage of existing knowledge, and I'm in the business of the marriage of existing technologies, and I think that UC System can go through some of their history and look at some of the things that they know of that they can put together with other things that can be applied and be a great source of revenue for the UC system. And I'll take my answer off there. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Henry Bourne.
Well, the question is, will it be a source of revenue for the UC system? There are kind of two sets of innovations in translational medicine that need to be made. One of them is early on in the path of discovery going towards a drug before, or towards a treatment. And those are much more like basic science. There you could patent it. There are other discoveries that are that need to be made that have to do with applying what we already even have in a more effective way in making sure that, for example, doctors follow checklists when they're dealing with extraordinarily complicated procedures that they're doing, or that they don't prescribe ask for tests that aren't really necessary. There's a huge number of applications problems that need to be dealt with as well. It's hard to make money from those. You can't. So the money will have to be made, if there's going to be money made for UCSF, in discoveries of new therapies. And we'll see whether that happens. Industry has not been enormously fascinated by the notion of giving huge quantities of money to the universities. But one of these days, I think they're going to realize that they absolutely depend on the universities for what they do.
But you mentioned synthetic biology. I can't help thinking about someone that I've worked with, Craig Vintner, who has made some pretty large sums of money, to put it mildly, and did it in the private sphere. I mean, through private enterprise. There, you've got this sort of implicit battle going on in many ways between the institutions, and here you write about this institution was thriving so much and it was getting a lot of money from NIH, but now a lot of that's being eclipsed by, particularly in biotechnology and things like synthetic biology, by the private sector.
And I think that's as it should be. I mean, one of the things that is happening, I think, is that scientists are one of the things that the book talks about is at the beginning of the recombinant DNA world, there was huge opposition to university professors making a dime from their work.
There was also huge opposition to recombinant DNA. I mean, they thought it was going to ruin the world.
Everybody.
Yeah, right.
And it didn't ruin the world, nor did a lot of people get vastly rich. A few did, but it didn't actually hurt anything. And so there's been a big change there. Now, Keith Yamamoto, who fought hard against Boyer's starting a company at UCSF, is spending much of his time trying to get companies to invest in UCSF, and they're succeeding. That is actually beginning to happen.
As I said, this is something the Chancellor would like to see to a much greater degree.
Right, and I think it will happen, but there's a huge gulf of cultures, both in business and in the universities, that has to be not just overcome. It has to be dealt with. Each of them is really talking about real things. They're not making up the difference between industry and universities. There is a huge difference, and there should be, but it has to be dealt with.
I think our next caller, Danielle, has something to say about money. Danielle, welcome.
Hi. So my question is, my dad's a mechanical engineering professor at a university in the Midwest, and he does a lot of stuff with rehab technology, and he found that a lot of the time that he has is spent finding grants for his PhD students, because they don't PhD students in science don't pay tuition, instead they're funded by grants that their professors get. So he finds that his own expertise is spent instead of on doing his research on instead finding grants, and that he's wondering if, or I guess I've heard him voice the concern many times that there should be a better way of having that happen, so that people with the greater expertise can also perform the research.
That is, you have touched on one of the sorest parts of all basic scientists and translational scientists in the biomedical world. That is, how do we actually administer the money that we do give out, and how do we make it both equitable and correctly distributed? That is tough. The NIH gives out, spends about $30 billion every year. Now, by military standards, that's nothing, but it's a huge amount of money. And that money, some of it is, I think, being misspent. Most of it is being spent correctly, but there isn't enough, and it's not very flexible. And what we need to do is to think about why there are so many students doing this work, why there can't be some permanent employees that are doing that, and a bit fewer students who are just the top set of those students going into it. Because the pipeline is so full that they're spilling out into professions that have really very little to do with science in many cases. So there are lots of issues there that, well, if you're willing to wait several years, you'll read about in my next book.
I was just going to say, this sounds like the next book for Henry Bourne.
Okay. That book doesn't exist yet, and I'm not prepared to defend it yet.
Well, when you get a draft done, let me know. In the meantime, good luck with this one. Past innovation, discovering recombinant DNA, oncogenes, and prions in one medical school over one decade. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. And you can always continue this discussion on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment, or go to our Facebook page, or let us know what you think about what you hear on forum by calling our listener feedback line, 415-553-3300. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell, our interns, Keith Mansoni, Ernesto Morales, Kyle Palmer, Dana Verinsky, and Catalina Villegas. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.